This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Kerry Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles. And everyone listening all around the world on KABC.com. I am Alan Gervie, and I'm the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And this music is just going to keep going on and on.
And
it
on.
Will not stop. On and on and on and on. Isn't that a song, Kerry Kasem?
Wait, that's exactly what I was thinking. How'd you know?
What were you thinking?
On and on and on and on.
I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of a Rapper's Delight. Remember that song?
I do. Sing it. Just do the on and on part.
Now, what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat. Meet the crew and my friends are going to try and move your feet. See, I am Wonder Mike and I'm... Okay, I'm not going to go into
that. That's pretty good.
It goes on and on and on and on. The beat don't stop till the break of dawn.
Say hip, hop. The hip, hop to the hippity hip. People are like turning off the radio.
No, they're not. They love it. They love my sexy voice with my cough. And there we go.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
That's what we should open the show with from now on. Yeah.
Very nice. Very nice.
Nice. Thanks, Jose.
It's not really rapid side, but tonight I'm going to the Hollywood Bowl, and actually they're doing the big disco summer Hollywood Bowl thing.
Oh,
I'm not sure
that.
Who's there. I go every year, so it's like Village People and some of the other Casey
lot.
And the Sunshine Band and whoever else. I should check to see who's there, but we will be there tonight. So we'll do the disco thing, and it's a lot of fun.
John Williams is fun. Have you ever done that night?
I have done the John Williams night.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're here to talk law. We could talk music for the rest of the afternoon, but we had kind of an exciting, actually with music, we would talk about unfortunate suicide.
Yes.
It wasn't O.J. Simpson, although it occurred on the same day of the O.J. Simpson hearing.
No, Chester Bennington from Linkin Park. And I had the pleasure of interviewing him a couple times, and he was such a nice man, genuinely kind. You know,
that's what I heard.
You know when people come in fake and they may not be so nice, but they're just being nice for the interview. He was genuinely kind to everybody, all the staff, everybody.
So sad.
Yeah.
You know, mental illness is really important, and I think, and depression and everything that causes people to take their own lives, and we need to do more research. We need to put more money into it because it's an epidemic.
You know, it is an epidemic, but people are not looking at the one thing that can help, and not all of it. Not everything's going to help, but food. The food and your gut, and they have said this over and over, and some people listen, most people don't, but what goes into your system and in your gut affects your mind and your feeling and the way and how you, your depression. And there's so much research that has been done on this that people just go, poo-poo, no, thank you. I'll take a pill and look at what you're eating.
I'm really confused. You're talking about poo-poo and food.
Let's
focus. Forget the poo-poo.
God, Alan.
So we have a great show today. We are going to talk shortly to Dick DeGaren. Dick DeGaren is Robert Durst's attorney. And Dick DeGaren was on our show about a year and a couple months ago. And we were talking about the big murder trial of Robert Durst that will be taking place in the fall. At the time last year, we thought it was going to be earlier, but there's been some delays, as some of these cases tend to have. And Dick DeGaren is going to be in court on Monday. Monday, they have preliminary hearings on the Robert Durst case for the murder of Susan Berman, 2000, in the year 2000. And we're going to talk all about that with Dick DeGaren. And then later in the show, You're going to, you've got.
I'm excited about this one.
Christine Pelisic.
Yes, she is a reporter, and she kind of cracked this case. It's a serial killer called the Grim Sleeper, Lonnie Franklin Jr., and it's actually going to be featured on People Magazine Investigates. That's on Investigation Discovery. And how she cracked this and what she found out is pretty amazing.
Okay, we'll look forward to talking to Christine later in the show, but first, we've got to talk about what everyone's talking about, because Gervie's Law would really not be doing its job if we didn't have the top legal analyst on our show to talk about the O.J. Simpson parole hearing. Ann Bremner was all over the media over the last couple days on MSNBC, HLN, CNN. And now a couple days have passed, and we get to have Ann Bremner, who is one of the greatest lawyers in the country, Seattle's best, I like to call her. And, of course, she is a former prosecutor. Ann Bremner, welcome back to Gervie's Law.
Thanks for the honor to be with both of you. Thank you.
So good to have you back on the show.
It sounds...
Thank you.
Oh, there you go. You sound better now.
Okay.
You're probably just losing your voice because you've been on television so much in the last couple days, and you've been commenting on the OJ parole hearing. Now, a couple days have gone by. Have you had a chance to kind of take it all in? We've read about so many comments, a lot of passion, a lot of people upset, a lot of lawyers have kind of told people what the deal is. What is your position right now, 2 days after we find out that OJ will be free?
You know, I felt, you know, going into the hearing that by all accounts he should be granted parole just if we follow the letter of the law and the standards. It's kind of by the numbers, basically, how they looked at whether or not he should be paroled. And keep in mind, I mean, 80% of the prisoners in Nevada that were at their mandatory minimum, as he was, are paroled. So, you know, it seems that it would be a foregone conclusion that it would be, even though we know that the double homicide of Ronnie Nicole in L.A. weighed heavily on everyone's mind, this had to be totally separate. And frankly, his sentence was quite high, 9 years, when his co-defendants were given probation. But as all the dust settles, I look back, and what I said on the air was, before he appeared in the hearing, I said that he needed to be brief, he needed to be contrite, and he needed to be seated. And he really didn't do any of those
things.
None of it.
And
I mean, you know, it was kind of astonishing.
You know, and you make a real important point. You're separating the issue of the parole from what, you know, OJ presented himself as. Obviously, it didn't really matter what he was going to say. Everyone, I think, was interested to see, you know, OJ 9 years later. We haven't heard a lot from him. And a lot of people said he hasn't changed a bit. You know, there was arrogance. There was, you know, you say contrite and everything. But it's important. I think Mark Garagos said, for a crime that he was convicted for, he should have only been in prison for maybe a year or 2 years, and he did 9 years. So isn't that really what we're focusing on when the parole hearing took place?
Exactly. And, you know, with co-defendants getting probation and cutting deals, the other sentence that was even close to his was 27 months and got reversed based upon the alleged taint of OJ's media, you know, on the case. So
right.
9 years is a long time in this case. But the other thing that really got me was when he got out there, he couldn't remember if he had to pay restitution, and he didn't take certain classes that he was supposed to take. I mean, that's textbook parole hearing. You've got to come in and say, I've done this. He told me to do this. I did it. You know, all those kinds of things. So that was also astonishing to me. And then his lawyer said, oh, he did pay the restitution. So luckily that was handled. But it was just not only his arrogance and his denial of the crimes, but then he's trying to charm people, and then we saw that flash of anger in his eyes for a moment, which I think a lot of people noted.
And when you talk about anger, you know, we go back to his domestic violence background.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to hear your comments on that because, again, it is separate and apart from what he was convicted for. But a lot of people say, you know, when he said things like, I've lived a conflict-free, basically conflict-free life, but wasn't the domestic violence issue kind of separate from what the parole hearing was all about?
Right. I saw one argument by Keith Jarrett on Fox News. He wrote a piece saying that should have been considered because it's an aggravating factor, i.e. the other domestic violence, you know, aside from these homicides. I mean, he at least had pled no contest to at least one in Los Angeles. And so when you're looking at recidivism, you know, the potential for future violence is always indicated by prior violence. I think we all know that. And so should those things have been considered? Well, they weren't. But then he denied any kind of criminality or conflict in his life. And frankly, I don't know why the parole board didn't then come back at him and say that's not true. Because I think I was on there with Chris Gordon a couple of days ago, and that was extremely upsetting to him. That statement.
It doesn't make sense that they wouldn't have taken that into consideration and said, okay, this guy, he has no accountability. There's no responsibility. Why are they letting him out?
Well, exactly. And it seems that some people have said the fix was in, and so they were going to parole him no matter what he said at the hearing. But I don't really think it's the fix was in. It was simply that they were worried about all the publicity and they wanted to look organized and have a decision that day as opposed to within days or weeks as is the norm. So what he had to say, did it make a difference? It didn't, I don't think, in his circumstances. Should it have made a difference? Absolutely.
Well, you know, a lot of people would think differently. A lot of lawyers look at the parole hearings kind of in a vacuum and not looking at the big picture. Although when we think about the future, now he will be out possibly in October sometime. What do you see for OJ's future? And obviously, you don't have a crystal ball in front of you, but given what you've seen from the past, what do you predict for the future?
I think he's like a moth to the flame. I think he always wants to be liked and adored. That's the most important thing to him. That means media. That means, you know, reality shows. That means, you know, blogging, like you said in the letter that was cited. You know, I just don't think he can go quietly into that dark night. I just saw a dark day. He simply needs to have that kind of attention, and he needs to make a living, although he has plenty of money left because of his pension. They're all saying he has at least $400,000 saved and $25,000 a month is in income from the pension.
That's yeah, the NFL pension.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But it seems that given what we've seen of what he did after the murder acquittals, you know, he was doing some things in Florida, as we saw in that O.J. Simpson Made in America piece by ESPN.
Right.
That he was involved in a lot of things that were kind of questionable, but were very public.
And the Goldmans still have a civil judgment against him. Apparently, his pension from the NFL is not going to be subject to payment of the lawsuit. What happens there? Will he have any responsibility of paying the Goldmans?
Yeah, it's ongoing. They got his Heisman Trophy, and of course they got his book that was called If I Did It. They got the rights to the book and published it as I Did It, as a confession. And so anything that he makes, they can go and take away from him. And part of this robbery and assault case and kidnapping case was involved with their potential property. When he said, I have all my stuff, it's not his fault. Anything, memorabilia, you know, any type of money that he's made until he pays back $33.5 million, doesn't belong to him.
And that will never happen, so they'll just keep taking things from him.
Yeah.
I mean, this man, go ahead, he's a criminal, and I think he's going to do something
again. Wait a second here.
He was in jail for it.
We have Dick DeGaren waiting to come on, and you just said he's a criminal.
No, you're not going to segue with that. You are not going to segue with that. That is so unfair. O.J. Simpson is a criminal. Robert Durst, in my eyes, is, but he has not been tried yet, and that's why we have Dick DeGaren on to talk about that.
But, you know, we have to, this is a legal show, and of course, Carrie's not a lawyer, so she can say what she wants. I'm very careful, I'm very measured, and I know Ann Bremner is as well, because she has seen a few cases in her day, and I think that, you know, the bottom line on this with O.J. Simpson is people don't like him for good reason. I don't think they should. People don't appreciate the arrogance. To see him in the parole hearing, I don't think people felt like he even understood what he did wrong or he cared. But the bottom line, Anne, isn't it that's the way the law works? You do your time, you get out. And he did his time. He's getting out.
Right, and parole is an act of grace, and he should have been humbled thereby, but he wasn't. So he did his time, and he's getting out. The question is whether or not he's going to stay out.
That's right. And that's a good question. We will have to have you back on, and we love having you on because you have,
I love you guys.
You have such great insight in all of these issues. Let's hope that the O.J. Simpson story kind of goes into the background for a while. I'm sure he will crave publicity and be out in the limelight come next fall. But I think we will be turning our attention to the Robert Durst trial in the fall, and whatever O.J. does, let him, he's history, he's the past. And thanks for being on with us.
Thanks, Ann.
And I know you love Dick DeGaren, so you can listen in on the after the break, because we're going to bring Dick DeGaren on, and we're going to talk about the Robert Durst case. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervie and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Hey, it's Peter Tilden, and I want to tell you about Flooring Pros. Their selection and prices are definitely going to floor you because they've got beautiful natural hardwoods, laminates, vinyl, and tile, and they can beat the price of the big national advertiser who you see advertised every day by as much as 50%. And they get it done right because they have an enormous selection and everything is in stock. That means you can get a free estimate one day and installation the very next day. So check out FlooringPro.com. They're on Google. They're on that beautiful website, Houzz, and check out their Yelp reviews. They're fantastic. So for the largest selection of the finest hardwoods, environmentally friendly flooring, laminates, exceptionally trained experts, and the best price guaranteed, call the number one flooring company in Los Angeles, FlooringPro.com at 800-815-1565. That's 800-815-1565. Call them for a free estimate or go to FlooringPro.com.
Flooring Pro, their prices will floor.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes, we're back. Dick's going to be so happy with us. We get some good music for him, that's for sure. We don't mess around here. Texas is coming to L.A. Texas in L.A., that's right. Dick DeGaren has some important business here, and Dick was on our show approximately a year ago, and we expected that the trial of Robert Durst would take place last summer, or at least into last fall, but now it seems like it will be actually coming to pass in the fall, as we have a preliminary hearing Monday in 2 days. And Dick DeGaren, Robert Durst's attorney, is in town. He's in L.A. Welcome back to Gervie's Law, Dick.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You, of course, have represented some very important figures. David Koresh, U.S. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, Tom DeLay, Alan Stanford, amongst a host of others. But you're getting a lot of press these days for the Robert Durst case, which a guy you've known for many, many years. And you told us last time that, you know, of course, you were successful when you represented him on the killing of Morris Black, who was one of his neighbors a few years back. And now he is finally going to stand trial on the Susan Berman murder. Tell us, Dick, why it's taken so long to get Robert in court.
Well, it's California.
That's true.
That's true.
That's a simple answer. Let me say first, I'm not going to discuss the facts of the case. I know I made that rule with you the last time.
Right.
I will say that Bob Durst didn't kill Susan Berman, and he doesn't know who did. That having been said, what's things take a long time in California. What's coming up next week is a hearing, and we'll have some witnesses. And then the actual preliminary hearing will be in October. And that's a hearing under California law where the judge decides whether there's enough evidence to go forward with the trial. If he decides that there is, and that's a big if, then we'll have the trial probably next spring or summer. So we might be still a year away from the starting of the trial.
Now, I appreciate you explaining that to the listeners because it gets confusing, and of course you qualified it by saying it's California, but isn't it true that they are looking to have videotape testimony for certain witnesses? Of course, the witnesses are getting older. This case has been, not going on for a long time, but at least the murder took place, or the death took place. I'm not going to say a murder because, again, I want to be fair that we don't know what happened to Susan Berman, but the death took place a long time ago. So why would they have filmed video of testimony when, by all accounts, we like to see that live where you have an opportunity to cross-examine the witnesses?
Well, under California law, there's a provision where if someone is over 65, just that fact alone allows the prosecution to, or the defense, to ask that their testimony be preserved in what's called a conditional witness hearing. That's what's going to happen this week. It's happened already in the case. And then there's, in a trial setting with a judge and videotape or video recording,
right,
is preserved. But it can only be used if the witness is not available at trial. So it's not exactly like a deposition. It's not exactly like a substitute for the witness being present. It's a kind of a safety valve, I suppose, because people are getting older and memories are getting faded and so forth.
So in other words, if the people, the witnesses are available, they won't be using this videotaped testimony. And that being the case, though, are there proceedings where the judge has to make evidentiary decisions on objections and things, even though the trial hasn't started?
Yes, and the lawyers can object during the proceeding. For the most part, the court is inclined to allow the testimony in, even though it might be objectionable, because they're preserving the testimony.
Right.
And at a later time, when the trial is going on, it may become more clear as to how the testimony is relevant or how it's admissible.
So with Stuart and Emily Altman, they are two people who, will they be having their video testimony taken? Or I read somewhere where their lawyer had objected because this was a situation they were friends or are friends of Bob Durst, and they were ordered from New York to vis-a-vis a subpoena to come out and do testimony, and then their attorney Elizabeth Johnson objected. What's the status with Stuart and Emily Altman?
Well, that's still to be determined. Emily Altman will be one of the witnesses week, but there is a real issue on the attorney-client privilege. Stuart Altman is a lawyer, and he's been a lawyer and a good, long-time good friend of Bob Durst, and Bob goes to him frequently with his issues and questions about the law, and Stuart has counseled with him as a lawyer for at least 30 years.
So how would you differentiate?
Yeah,
I was going to say, how would you differentiate between attorney-client privilege under those circumstances and other testimony which may be relevant, which the court may want to hear from Stewart? Is that something that you would be objecting to, or would his attorney be objected to, or how would you get that testimony in?
Well, let me explain it by helping understand about what the lawyer-client privilege is. It belongs to the client. When you or I go to a lawyer, it may be someone that we've known for a long time, it may be a stranger, but when we do, when we seek advice, when we lay out a problem and seek advice, then all of that is privileged. That's sacrosanct. It's just not to be inquired into. It's,
right.
It belongs to the client. It doesn't belong necessarily to the lawyer, but both lawyers representing the Altmans and Bob Durst lawyers will object to inquiry into anything that might be privileged.
But the Altmans, and correct me if I'm wrong, had given several interviews to news media outlets for the last 17, 18 years about Mr. Durst. So is it just, could they object to certain questioning and allow some other questioning? Would that seems like that would be fair.
I don't think anything that they've said in any interviews fell under the privilege. They've known Bob for a long time. They know him emotionally, and they've been very close friends for a long time. So there is a fuzzy line between being a friend and being a lawyer. When you go to a lawyer and you seek advice, what you say and what the lawyer says is all secret. It's privileged. That's the basis of our Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
Right. And isn't there a concern here that the jury pool could be tainted with some of the information that's released? I know there was a two-hour interrogation of Bob Durst that the prosecutors released, which you objected to. How does that figure into some of these issues of admissibility and tainting jury pool?
I've been concerned about that from the get-go. And I've tried to limit what I say about the case to scheduling and general principles, such as the attorney-client principle. But unfortunately, there have been things that have gotten out into the public, and so I'm concerned about our ability to get a fair jury. The judge assures us that he's going to take every precaution in selecting the jury, and I believe him. So, these preliminary hearings where witnesses testify, they're very well covered by the press, as is the right of the press to do.
Right.
And at the same time, it's getting the evidence out there before we even know whether we're going to trial or not.
Which is really important, because people don't seem to understand that there are some house cleaning things that lawyers need to do. It's not just as simple of putting everyone on the stand and getting a jury to provide a verdict. One of those potential witnesses, Michael Strzok, and he's been in the news, who is a retired New York Police Department detective. He was noticed as a defense witness. Will he be testifying this week? Or what about this issue of not paying for the dogs, because he's a dog sitter, and this airplane business that came out into the news this week?
Well, we think that we're limited in what we can provide to a witness, and anything over that limit could be construed as attempt to influence a witness. If a witness were given a two-week free vacation in sunny Southern California, for instance, that might be seen by some people as influential on his testimony. But to answer your question about Detective Strzok, no, we're not going to pay for his dog sitter. And so we're kind of at a standstill with that. He won't be here as far as I know.
And that's fine with you?
Well, I'm not going to get into the weeds about the what evidence he could provide. We think he could provide some very favorable evidence about the hard work that he did in the original investigation of Kathy Durst's disappearance.
And of course, before we go on, everyone, so everyone understands, Kathy Durst was Robert Durst's first wife, and she mysteriously disappeared many, many years ago, in the 1980s. And that has been the subject of Susan Berman, who was murdered in 2000. The prosecution would like the jury to believe that Susan Berman knew too much about the disappearance of Robert Durst's first wife. Is that right?
Well, that's the prosecution theory, but I don't buy it at all. And that's what lawsuits are made out of, is disagreements.
So let me ask you a question, Dick. If this guy might provide some favorable testimony, wouldn't you do anything to get that? Because it seems like that would be something Mr. Durst would need. And in California, when I went through a trial last year, we could do it telephonically. And I'm not sure if that's the same. I had a stalker case that I won with someone who was stalking me. And there were certain witnesses from across the country that were on the telephone. Is that not something you could do with this detective?
Well, not with the conditional witness statute. It requires a personal appearance in court. And we want that to happen. But at the same time, we don't want to be paying extravagant expenses for doing that. We're limited in what we can offer, and that's paid round-trip airfare, not first class, and it's a reasonable amount of money for food and living expenses. We had a nice hotel room reserved for him close to the airport. I don't think it was proper to demand that his wife come with him first class and that they get a dog sitter. I've already.
It's like a vacation.
Yeah, well, but if he's a witness that's going to give you favorable testimony, I would take that. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but my God.
Well,
I mean, you want to get somebody out there that's going to say this guy didn't do it. Okay, some evidence.
But, you know, you examine what you just said. You said you'd pay for good testimony. We won't.
That's right.
No, it's not paying for good testimony. If I was juror, hold on, I'm not a lawyer. I'm the only lawyer not on the radio right now.
You're not a lawyer.
That's right. But I could be if I was a juror, and I would, I don't care. I would immediately say, if I was Mr. DeGuerin, I would say, hey, you know, I don't want this to look like we've paid for this guy, but he wouldn't come here unless I gave his wife a first class ticket and paid for a stupid dog to be sat.
Yeah, don't call dogs stupid.
I'm a huge animal lover. You know, hold on a second. Hold on a second. You know how much I love animals. I'm just saying.
I understand.
I'm just saying, I would be upset about it. That's how I would come off as the lawyer and say, look, this is what we had to do to get this guy out here.
Dick,
and
let me ask
and
you.
And dogs, hold on. You've been talking the whole time, and I know it's your show, but I have to say one thing. We all love dogs here. I have to say
I'm not questioning
that
your
I'm
love
a little
of dogs.
Upset about all. Can you, do you have any information you could give me that would refute the different claims I've heard about his seven dogs that were gone in 6 months. Nobody would know what happened to Fred Durst.
Fred, who's Fred Durst?
I'm sorry, Fred Durst is the singer of he's the singer of a band.
Dick, I got it.
Hold on a second.
I want to
hold
say
on
something.
A second. Hold on.
You
Mr.
really
Durst.
Got care. You got Dick. You got
you
care.
Got me.
You know.
Can I finish
Dan,
it? I want to know about the dogs. I
Dan,
really do.
Dan Rather said of Dick DeGuerin, that there is not a better attorney. Taking a case to a jury, and you just took a case to Carrie Kasem, and she's all...
Look at me, I'm already messing it up.
You're messing
okay,
up.
But I just want to know about the dogs. There were these seven Alaskan Malamutes, if I'm saying that correctly. Do you know anything about that, Dick? Anything about those dogs?
That's part of the legend, and it's not accurate.
Okay.
The Bob Durst story. That's just bull. I guess I can't say the second half of that word.
Well, we know what you mean.
BS. Yeah. So, okay, he never had those dogs then?
He had a Malamute, and they had to put the Malamute down because of a disease that he had, but that's, and his name was Igor, or Igor, depending on how you pronounce it.
Okay.
And it's grown into, just been magnified into a false legend about the case.
Isn't it true, Dick, when you do cross-examine witnesses, a question that you might have asked many times is, what conversations did you have with your, not with your attorney, but with other people? Has anyone given you anything to testify? A lot of times people try to question the credibility of a witness by saying, what's in it for you? Isn't that something that's important to you?
It's always important to inquire into the motives of a witness. And it's important for the jury to know about possible influences that a witness has to color his or her testimony. And for that reason, there are statutes that limit the amount of money that can be provided.
Right. Dick? Did we lose him?
Did we lose him? Sounds like it.
Are you there, Dick? There you are.
Yes, I'm here. Yeah.
You're You're in LA. You're driving around sightseeing. Is that what happened? And what took your mind off of? You're at the Hollywood and Vine.
No, I thought you were hearing me. Are you hearing me now?
Yeah, now yes, we're hearing you. Yeah. So we have a couple more minutes, and I want to get into, because you said some interesting things there. You talked about influences, and we're seeing a lot about Robert Durst in the media. Of course, there's the HBO, the famous miniseries, The Jinx, which probably caused this whole thing. I think last time you were on, you said that what Robert Durst apparently was caught saying in the bathroom at the end of The Jinx about killing them all may have been the reason why he was finally, or he was at least accused of this murder. And now we have the Oxygen Channel, The Jury Speaks, The Strange Life of Robert Durst. That's coming out. There's been so much media attention. There's going to be another movie, I believe, on his life, a Lifetime movie, The Last Wife of Robert Durst. How does this impact you as his attorney as you prepare for trial?
Well, we've got to be cognizant of all that stuff that's out there and to break care in selecting a jury that's not influenced by it. Hopefully, jurors that haven't heard about it. That's going to be harder and harder to find.
What do you see as you move forward? You're here. How long you're here this week for the hearings, and then you go back to Texas, and then where do you go from here?
Well, we've got this week and perhaps next set aside for this round of hearings. When I get back to Texas, I start another murder case in a little town called Seguin, Texas, near San Antonio. And I go basically from trial to trial.
Wow, that's a busy schedule. You've got a lot of stuff going on, and I guess the excitement on the Robert Durst case probably will be quieted down a little bit after these hearings. And then when do you expect that it'll heat up and you will be back here to try the case for good?
Well, as I said, I think the next really big event will be the preliminary hearing, and that will be in October. And then it'll be set for trial probably in the late spring or maybe even summer of 2018.
Speaking of Texas cases, while we have you on the line, and it's interesting, you have another case to go to, and I'm sure it's a fascinating one. What about David Temple? That case, I know Kelly Siegler's talked about it, whether or not David Temple will be tried again.
Well, he shouldn't be, and the judge found in reviewing his case that there were over 30 instances of prosecutorial misconduct by the prosecutor in that case.
Was that Kelly Siegler, your arch nemesis?
Well, I wouldn't use the term nemesis, but
I faced
each other several times. I think. I know that David Temple is innocent, and I think that what will happen is that the special prosecutor that's been appointed will come to the same conclusion and perhaps go after the real killer. We know who that gang of thugs was.
Right.
There's much more evidence against them than there ever was against David Temple.
Do you have any idea why he was originally convicted?
Well, lost the case. That's the first thing.
Well, you must feel a little bit better about it when it's overturned. You've got to feel good about it. You didn't lose the case. You lost it, and then you got it back.
Well, and I feel exonerated, as David does, that a judge that took a close look at all of the things that the prosecutor did and hid from the defense caused there to be an unfair trial.
Right.
And so he'll either be tried again, which I don't think will happen, or the prosecutor, the special prosecutor, there's a special prosecutor been appointed. It's not the elected DA anymore. Will evaluate and see whether to go to trial or whether to take the evidence that we've discovered and go after the real killers.
All right, well, we'll keep an eye out on that. And, of course, we're going to keep an eye out on the Robert Durst case. You know, you promised us last time that you were going to come in studio when you're in L.A., and I know you couldn't do that today, but you will be back in the fall. We need to come face-to-face. We've got some great music here, great country music. You bring your hat in, and we welcome all Texan attorneys right here at KBC. I want to wish you all the best in the Durst case and your other cases that are coming up. And thanks again, Dick, for being on our show.
Well, thanks to both.
Thank you, Dick.
All right, take care. And we are going to be back with Christine Pelisic after this break. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
You ain't met my Texas.
There is more to me, Queen Eliara of Elfgard, than my elven magic. Just as there's more to Geico than saving you money, Geico also gives you 24/7 access to licensed agents online, on the phone, or on the Geico app. And while I am a mighty elf queen, I am also a mighty big fan of barbecue potato chips. Minions! More smoky mesquite.
Geico. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.
Attention small business owners, you know how hard it is to get funding to grow your business. Next Wave Funding is a direct funder that can help you get the cash you need when you need it, even if your credit is not that great. If you've been in business for over 1 year, have at least $12,000 in sales every month, Next Wave will purchase your future earnings and give you the money you need. It's as simple as that. This is by far the easiest and best funding for existing businesses. Call 800-430-4566. That's 800-430-4566.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Macy's Super Saturday Sale with 50 to 75% savings store-wide. Plus, use your savings pass and take $10 off a $25 purchase until 2 p.m. today and 3 p.m. Sunday. Find sizzling specials every day. Shorts, capris, and sandals for her, $19.99. 14-karat gold chains, 65% off. And men's tees, buy one, get one free. Right now at Macy's. Savings off sale prices, exclusions apply. Savings pass excludes specials.
Attention investors, protect your IRA or 401k by storing your retirement at home with an Augusta Home Delivery Gold IRA. Call Augusta today at 888-852-4788 for a free guide on transferring a portion of your IRA or 401k into approved physical gold and silver coins and store them in your safe at home or at your local bank. Call 888-852-4788 today and discover how you can get up to $2,000 in silver free. Call 888-852-4788. That's 888-852-4788.
You're listening to Gervais Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law. Oh, Jose.
Roxanne.
Jose. Almost caught me.
Roxanne.
I'm Carrie Casey. I'm here with our host, Alan Gervie. Oh, Alan's looking at me. He's like, you know what? You're going to take this one. And I will, because I am so interested in this story.
Prostitution.
No, actually, that's wrong, Alan. That's very wrong. That was you.
Put on your red light.
Actually, no, it's the Grim Sleeper case. And Christine Pelisic, she's a reporter that actually broke this. I mean, what I've been reading, this woman actually, I think, is the reason why this man is behind bars. Christine, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to the show. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the case in Lonnie Franklin Jr.
Lonnie Franklin Jr. is a serial killer who was murdering women in South Los Angeles from the early 80s until he was caught in Los Angeles in 2010 through familial DNA testing. He was put on trial for the murder of 10 women and the attempted murder of another woman. And he got the death penalty in August, but the police think that he probably killed more than 30 women. A lot of the women were found in trash bins and dumpsters in the South Los Angeles area. He was a sanitation worker, married, father of two, grandfather, and he dumped the bodies in alleyways. You know, they don't know whether he was working at the time, but, you know, he had intricate knowledge of the alleyways, given the fact that he was a sanitation worker with the L.A. County Department of Sanitation. And the police knew he was operating back in the 80s, but at the time there was six other serial killers operating at the same time, which made it very difficult for the police to figure out what was going on. His MO was quite, he shot his victims in the chest with a 25 caliber, so they knew, you know, his killings were separate from the others. And so he basically, as I said, there were so many serial killers at the time, they started a task force to look into all of the cases. At one point, they thought it was one guy. They dubbed the Southside Slayer. As time went on, they realized that there was more than one killer. A couple of them got caught in the 80s, and then a few of them got caught when the LAPD started its cold case unit in 2001. But Lonnie Franklin Jr. was still out there, and they thought in 1988, that he sort of went away. There was like a 13-and-a-half-year gap. So they thought that, you know, maybe he was in prison, he died or whatever. And so, you know, police basically forgot about the case until he struck again in 2002 and killed a 15-year-old runaway named Princess Berthemieu. And he strangled her. And then in 2003, he killed a 35-year-old mother of two. In 2007, he killed another young mother, 25-year-old girl, and dumped her body in a dumpster. And at that point, the LAPD, you know, kind of decided to get a task force together to look into it. And it kind of went from there. But I found out about a year earlier.
You were the one, was it the coroner's office that came and said, hey, there's something fishy going on here. We don't really know happening.
Well, the coroner, I had gone to see the coroner. I used to, you know, drop by the coroner a lot, and he had told me that the coroner's office, L.A. County coroner, basically was looking into these 38 body dump cases, and it was all women that were found in dumpsters or parks and alleyways all over Los Angeles from 2002 to 2006. And the coroner's office noticed that there was just so many of them, and they wondered if, and, you know, some of these cases might be linked. So they tried to reach out to the sheriff and the LAPD and some of the other law enforcement agencies around LA County. And, you know, basically the cops were like, you know, these, you know, don't worry about it. Deal with the, you know, the dead bodies. We're the police. We can handle our cases. And so they decided to kind of do it on their own, but they were really, really busy. You know, they have, you know, dozens of cases a day at the coroner's office that come in, that come in. So the investigators, coroner investigators really didn't have the time. And so I finally was able to convince the coroner to give me this list of 38 women. So I started going through the list, and then I got to the last. A lot of the cases turned out that they weren't, you know, work of a serial killer. Some of them were actually women dying of natural causes and, you know, things like that, or their boyfriend killed them or whatever. But I ended up getting to case number 37, and that was actually Princess Berthemieu. And then I ended up, and that was an Inglewood case, and so then I went to talk to the Inglewood detective, and he actually told me that Princess's case was linked to an LAPD case in 2003, which was Valerie McCulvey, the 35-year-old mother of two, and those two cases were linked to the series of murders that happened in the 80s. And so I ended up doing a story about it, and it just, no one seemed to care. And then he had struck again, and then I found out again, I was looking through autopsy reports and found out that he had struck again. And then the LAPD also, you know, right after, you know, a few months after Janisha Peters in 2007 died, the LAPD started a task force to look into it, but they didn't tell the community. So I ended up doing a story about it and, you know, basically saying that, you know, there was a lot of outrage in the community because there was a serial killer out there and the police had not told anyone.
Did you go to his trial? Did you go there? Was there any remorse? Did this guy say, was there anything that did he admit to anything?
No.
Nothing.
No. He kept his head down. And then when he looked straight ahead, like sort of, he focused on a spot, like kind of next to the judge's head. And anytime he walked into the courtroom, he kind of looked down, you know, because there was a lot of family members there. And the only time he looked up was when his girlfriend showed up, and he kind of looked up at her one time she showed up, and, you know, he looked up at her and then kind of put his head down. So, but no, he's always denied, you know, everything. He thought the police were out to get him, and the police planted his DNA and all the photos. They found hundreds of photos of naked women in his home. Like when they arrested him, they did this search on his home and they found hundreds of photos, including some photos of his victims, as well as one of the 25 caliber weapons that he used to kill two of his victims. And, you know, he made excuses why he had those photos to his family.
And this is what he's saying, like the police planted all of this evidence just to get this poor sanitation worker. Where was I'm just trying to understand why would the police want to get him in the first place? Where did that come from?
Well, they wouldn't, but he was just trying to make excuses.
Sure. That's what I'm trying to say.
His family and friends, he's not going to admit to them, like, oh, yeah, I killed all these women, so he's going to make stuff up. Like, no, these weren't my photos of naked women. They were friends, and they just happened to leave them in stacks, you know, in my home. And no, that wasn't my weapon. You know, the police are planting things. You know what I mean? It's something you say in order to, you know, and you hope that your family's going to buy it, basically.
Now, this was covered in, People Magazine Investigates on Discovery ID. Are they going to, I know a lot of times, you know, it's played over and over again. Is that the same with this show?
Well, we have at People Magazine, we did 10 shows last year. People Magazine Presents, and
yes,
Grim Sleeper was one of them. And I'm not sure if it's going to replay. We have, we're doing 10 more this year. And they start coming out in November, and so we have 10 new shows. But, I think that it would be great if there'd be more shows about this case, because I think people should really know about it. You know, a lot of people don't know. You know, they know about, you know, Robert Durst and a lot of other cases,
sure,
but a lot of them don't know about the, you know, Grim Sleeper case. And it's a really sort of fascinating case because there are so many red herrings along the way, and you know, one point in time, they thought it was a L.A. County sheriff that was responsible. And,
wow,
you know, and the fact that they found him through familial DNA, because he was, I mean, they knew he was the killer, but they didn't know he wasn't in any felon or, you know, CODIS data bank. So they didn't know who he was. And it wasn't until they tried that familial search. Well, they tried it in 2008. It failed. They tried it again in 2010. And at that point, the felon data bank had grown 400,000 people, and then they ended up hitting on his son, and that's how he ended up getting caught, through his 28-year-old son.
You know, this is, I agree. I think things like this should be out there. It should get more attention, especially, I mean, warning the public. And I'm glad that you're doing the show. And can you give me anything, any juicy tidbits of the next season coming up?
We have actually, I don't know a lot of, unfortunately, I don't know a lot of the shows that are going to be out yet because they haven't announced it. So, unfortunately, I can't.
I'm just so happy to hear you say out.
I knew you were going to say that. I'm going to say, are you Canadian?
I'm fascinated. She's from Ottawa. And you know, I love hearing a fellow Canadian. I was just waiting the whole interview just so you would say about or out like a Canadian. I feel so great to hear that Ottawa accent. Christine, thank you so much for being on Gervie's Live. We'll have to check in with you on some of these other stories. They sound incredibly exciting. And there's something that we do need to tell the public about.
Absolutely.
And my book, just so you, of course I'm plugging, but my book came out a few weeks ago, The Grim Sleeper. So if anyone's interested, please, it's at Barnes & Noble, and you can get it on Amazon.